morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, April 24th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Fighting continues in Sudan 9 days after it began as diplomats and other nationals flee.
They never stopped for the whole 8 days. We tried to make a truce, humanitarian truce, because you see there are so many bodies in the streets. It's being eaten by the dogs. No one can take them away.
We'll also discuss the prescription for peace in Sudan. Liberia begins phase two of voter registration for its 2023 general elections. Burundi says it has detained former Prime Minister Bonyani, who it said had gone missing. Millions of children miss out on vaccination as the world marks immunization week beginning today, Monday.
Africa registered tremendous progress in improving access to immunization services. But despite this progress, about 30 million children in Africa are estimated to suffer from vaccine-preventable diseases each year.
And thousands of displaced struggle to survive in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Those stories plus Samson Omale's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sudan's former foreign minister says Army Commander General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and Rapid Support Forces Commander General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo must agree to a permanent ceasefire and finalize the terms of forming a unified professional national army. This as fighting continues despite an agreed 3-day ceasefire to observe El Fitr. The United States and United Kingdom have evacuated their diplomats and their families, and some Arab nations also have pulled out their citizens. Mariam Sadiq al-Mahdi was foreign minister from February 2021 until November 2022. She resigned in protest over a political agreement between then Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok and General al-Burhan. Al-Mahdi says once al-Burhan and Dagalo have reached a permanent truce and agreed on the terms of constituting a unified national army, negotiations will begin to transfer power to civilians. She tells me that the situation in Khartoum is unimaginable as some fighters have been taking up positions in heavily populated areas of the city.
Wallahi, we are trying to hold on, Janice. It has been now very long and very horrifying 8 days. Today, since morning, for the first time, we had to go down to the basement because the shelling was very intense and was very close all around us. It's really very bad, and we are now out of electricity since yesterday, totally out of electricity. We are out of water for the last 7 days. I had a bath last Saturday and only yesterday. It is very bad. We ran out of anything to eat, but the good thing, we have lots of dates from Ramadan. We don't know much of the news of the people. We haven't been out for the last 8 days, and so on and so forth. It is really bad, very bad, and unimaginable.
Exactly so, madam. And you say unimaginable. As I speak with you now, is there still fighting in Sudan or in Khartoum?
Yes, yeah, there is still fighting. They never stopped for the whole 8 days. We tried to make a truce, humanitarian truce, because you see there are so many bodies in the streets. It's now, a'uzu billah, it is being eaten by the dogs. No one can take them away. More than 60% of our hospitals run out of business because there is no water, and they run out of medicines. Also, the health providers, all of them, they are consumed because no one is replacing them. People are being besieged in many areas, only under, they can live only under their beds because of the intense shelling and the bombardment by the airplanes, by heavy artillery.
I ask the question because, madam, there have been talks of a ceasefire.
Yes, there was attempted 3 ceasefires. I am amongst the groups who have been running between the two to try to effect ceasefire. But none of them lived more than minutes. Even the last one yesterday, the last one was much more promising because it was the first day of the Eid, because people really got tired and really in need. We thought it would continue for at least 3 hours, but it didn't. And since this morning, early in the very early hours of the morning, we have been under shelling. I don't know who is shelling whom, but it is all around.
Now, how do you think this can come to an end?
It must come to an end by consent. They must agree to a truce. and that truce can go on for permanent ceasefire. And we see the terms of how to finalize the terms of constituting one unified professional national army. At the same time, we negotiate with them the submission of power to the civilians. Do you hear the voice of ammunition now?
Yes, I do.
I am inside the basement. Very.
Are you safe where you are?
No one is safe in Khartoum. No one is safe. There is no safety. Safety is done with. And the fighters actually are taking refuge in the mostly heavily populated neighborhoods. For some time, it was not only the most populated, but also the most secure ones.
Thank you very much, madam. And keep safe.
Thank you very much, James. Thank you for calling again.
Mariam Sadiq Al-Mahdi was Sudan's foreign affairs minister from February 2021 until November 2022. She was speaking with me from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. As a spurious three-day ceasefire ended Sunday in Sudan, some regional analysts expect the worst in the Northeast African nation's conflict between Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, the RSF. United States President Joe Biden announced on Saturday the successful extraction of U.S. government personnel from Sudan and the temporary suspension of the U.S. embassy operations in the capital, Khartoum. VOA's Nabil Biagio reached Cameron Hudson, senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., to understand what the latest development means for Sudan.
What it means is that the United States has sent a signal that it has left. And I think what you're seeing as a result of that is many other missions, many other civilians trying to flee the city as well. So we're seeing now an exodus of people trying to get out of the city. The fact that the United States has left, the largest country, I think is a real indicator of the perilousness that people face in the city. And so it has unleashed a torrent of people trying to leave Khartoum for safer places. What's interesting is that the United States has not declared that it is reconstituting or reopening its embassy, for example, in Djibouti or Nairobi, which is a typical response when embassies are evacuated. We still maintain embassy services for citizens and others from a neighboring country. That announcement has not been made, so it's not clear to me if our diplomats are returning to Washington or if they will stay in the region and eventually try to reopen an embassy in exile. That's still to be determined.
And today is the end of a supposed three-day ceasefire between the Sudan Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces. And like you just mentioned, families also I speak with in Khartoum are leaving the capital and many are leaving the country altogether. Are we entering even a bloodier episode of this brutal conflict?
Yes, I think the situation in Khartoum is about to get much, much worse. As international employees leave, I think there will be less concern about what happens to Sudanese civilians, and I think that that will be create a situation where the violence is even worse.
Is there hope at all for stopping this conflict at this point?
No, I don't see any hope in stopping this conflict right now. The parties very clearly want to fight, despite what they say about protecting civilians. They are very clearly interested in fighting more than they are interested in talking or negotiating. And I think that the recognition that you see the diplomatic community leaving Sudan is also an indication that they don't believe that these parties are at all interested in talking. And so I think we are in for a much bloodier battle to come, and I would expect to see the fall of Khartoum to these forces in the coming days.
That was Cameron Hudson, senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He was speaking with my colleague Nabil Biagio in Washington, D.C. Burundian authorities say they have taken into custody the country's former prime minister, Guillaume Boyoni. The government announced last week it was looking for Boyoni, but that he had gone missing. Burundian officials did not respond to VOA's request for an interview. Boyoni was fired last September after President Evariste Ndayishimiye warned of a possible coup plot. The New Times newspaper in neighboring Rwanda quotes Burundi public prosecutor Sylvester Nyandwi as saying that evidence showing crimes was being collected. Agathon Rwasa is the leader of Burundi's main opposition National Congress for Liberty Party. He tells me that the public is also in the dark about the actual allegations against Bonyani.
We heard just early this week that there was a search in his house, but he was not around. Then some 2 days ago, we heard that he was arrested. This morning, a notice or a communique from the general prosecutor that he had ordered that perquisition of the house of Bunyoni, and then after his warrant of arrest, and that he's gathering proofs so that he can be trialed. That's all what we know. There is no more communication about this.
Any crime against him? Was he charged with any crime? Is there anything the government said he might have done?
When he was removed from office in September last year, there was some kind of allegations that he was plotting a coup against the head of state, something like that. But everybody was astonished to see that if really he was plotting against the regime, how come he was not arrested? So according to hearsay, he said that he has been misusing public wealth, that he have gathered billions of money illegally. That maybe it can be linked with this. But there is no clarification about why he was treated so. We are just waiting to see what will the prosecution say concerning this Bunyoni.
You are exactly right, because the public prosecutor, Mr. Nyandwi, did not specify what happened. He only said that there were evidence that shows that crimes had been committed and are being collected.
Yeah, that's why we don't know exactly what is going on, because if it is just only allegations, till they again can show proofs, then we can't believe that this arrest is a legal one. Otherwise, it may be something linked with their political business themselves.
Agathon Rwasa is the leader of Burundi's main opposition National Congress for Liberty Party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Bujumbura. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, April 24. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. Liberia has begun phase two of its biometric voter registration exercise, and already there are reports of problems in the participating nine counties. As Denise Nipson reports from Monrovia, the process, which began April 21, is expected to conclude on May 11.
Phase one of Liberia's biometric voter registration exercise ended with many complaints about glitches that hampered the process in the six counties involved. The problems have discouraged some citizens from registering to vote in October's presidential election. Devieta Brown-Lasana is the chairperson of the National Elections Commission. Before the second phase started, she said the NEC has corrected the problems to ensure they are not repeated in the remaining nine counties.
In order to address potential glitches in the second phase, Commission 13 April held a one-day internal lessons learned workshop to understand the challenges were encountered in phase one, such as improper connection and powering of the equipment, VVR centers ownership, timing of meal allowance payment, logistics, amongst others. Having identified the root causes of the challenges, the NEC is taking remedial actions to better the second phase.
However, just a few days into the second phase, the nine counties taking part are reporting similar problems. In Maryland County, Chris Weir is one of the registrants who ran into challenges.
Never seen this morning around 6. I left my house this morning. I went to Jiritao, Kadine Campo, the big campo this morning. Because we were there this morning, even one person did not even able to work on this morning. We were there, they said, well, TV person to come and look at the machine. And the post said that the machine had problems. So up to the time, one person did not even work on. So this reason we told by to even kind of people to the city hall, because we know that the card is very important to us. But we to the city hall again, we just mean to do like the people pushing people, they close the door, so no way for us to get our car. So we are appealing to the net to see.
People in Granku County report the same issues. David Nimler recounts his experience.
It's not easy, yo. Since 7 o'clock this morning, I left the house. I came here, some people are ignoring me, but the process is too slow. Before they finish one person, then after more than 2-3 minutes, we'll still be waiting. So since this morning, I've been here. After two now, I haven't eaten anything. I'll stay waiting just to take off one voter ID card.
From Bond County, James Peewee says it was not easy to register.
The process in which I got my voter registration card was very heavy. To come here and see only one computer people using, camera one, printer one, by red, our librarian coordinator will use more than 2 or 3 of this machine to run through the process. Because you go check, night check on the line, you see human being fighting just to get an ID card. And which of course will be so, by red people jumping through the window. I'm one of those who jumped through the window.
Before the biometric voter registration process began, there were calls for the government to ensure that the NEC received the resources needed to effectively complete. The commission, however, has said it did not get the needed funding. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I'm Denise Nipsin in Monrovia, Liberia.
As the world marks Immunization Week starting today, Monday, the United Nations Children's Fund says children born just before or during the pandemic are now moving past the age when they would normally be vaccinated. At least 67 million children missed out on vaccinations between the years 2019 and 2021, with vaccination coverage decreasing in 112 countries globally. Maureen Ojiambo reports.
This year's report by the United Nations Children Fund, UNICEF, indicates that the past 3 years were the biggest vaccine backslide immunization in the past 30 years. World Immunization Week is celebrated the last week of April to highlight the actions needed to protect people from vaccine-preventable diseases. UNICEF Executive Director Catherine Russell says the COVID-19 pandemic led to a child immunization setback, with millions of children missing out on routine vaccines.
As a result, diseases that were nearly eradicated or controlled, like polio, measles, and diphtheria, are making a comeback. This is a red alert for child health. It's putting every child, family, and community at risk.
The World Health Organization says in Africa, 33 million children will need to be vaccinated between 2023 and 2025 to put the continent back on track to achieve the 2030 global immunization goals, including cutting mortality rates from vaccine-preventable diseases. Joseph Kabore is the Director of Program Management for the WHO Regional Office for Africa. He says the number of children who have never received a single dose of vaccine increased from 7.7 million in 2020 to 12 million in 2022.
Africa registered tremendous progress in improving access to immunization services. But despite this progress, about 30 million children in Africa are estimated to suffer from vaccine-preventable diseases each year. In 2023, 31 African countries experienced an outbreak of vaccine-preventable diseases.
WHO African region officials say efforts must be made to ensure every child has access to vaccines. To recover from the pandemic's disruption aftermath, countries have worked to restore health services. Kabore says there must be equal access to immunization.
As we commemorate this year's African Vaccination and World Immunization Week, allow me to echo the vision of the regional immunization agenda for the African region, a region where everyone, everywhere, and at every age benefits from vaccines for good health and well-being. To achieve this vision, we all must deliver on our commitments to ensure universal access to immunization.
The Vaccine Alliance, known as Gavi, has expressed its commitment by working with countries to help catch up and restore immunization rates. Gavi is focusing on the needs of children, particularly in marginalized and conflict-troubled areas. Aurelia Nguyen is the Chief Program and Strategy Officer for Gavi.
Why we at Gavi, in very, very close collaboration with our alliance partners, WHO Afro, and the governments, including Sierra Leone and Ghana, are working hard in terms of our efforts to support countries to make up this lost ground and also to build stronger systems that are more resilient than ever.
Under the theme of the big catch up, WHO is working with partners to accelerate progress in countries trying to ensure more people, particularly children, are protected from preventable diseases. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Sacramento, California.
It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin this Monday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports with the 2023 London Marathon held on Sunday. Kenyan Kelvin Kiptum came agonizingly close to beating Eliud Kipchoge's world record marathon time, missing out by just 18 seconds as he got around the streets of London to win in 2 hours, 1 minute, 27 seconds. It was also the fastest course record time. Kiptum had produced the fastest marathon debut in Valencia in December, where he finished in 2 hours, 1 minute, 53 seconds, the third fastest time in history. His fellow Kenyan Geoffrey Kamawuru crossed the line to come in second place.
I'm very happy to run my second fastest time in history. My preparation was good. Everything was going on well. The secret is training. I've been training a lot. Everything is good. My training, very okay. I was very happy to be invited in London. I love the crowd cheering. That gives me a lot of motivation. I keep on pushing.
Staying with athletics, Zimbabwe head coach for the junior and youth athletics team, Biriat Mbuhu, says they are hoping to make the best of their week-long camp to ensure athletes are ready for the African Under-18 and Under-20 combined championships. The continental meet is set for Ndola, Zambia from April 29th to May 3rd. Zimbabwe are fielding both under-18 youth and under-20 juniors for the competition. The athletes are in camp in Harare, and the camp will run until their departure on Thursday. And onto football news, Riyad Mahrez scored the hat-trick in an FA Cup semi-final since 1958 on Saturday, as Manchester City kept their quest for the treble on course by outclassing Sheffield United at Wembley. The Algerian opened the scoring after Daniel Jebin fouled Bernardo Silva before taking advantage of a wide-open Sheffield United defence to score the second with a solo effort just after the hour. Mahrez got his third, the first in a semi-final in this competition since Alex Dawson achieved the feat for Manchester United in 1958.
Really good game. You know, we're really happy to have won here, 3-0, and to go to the final, because the last 3 years we came here in the semi-final and we always lost, you know. So we really wanted to make sure that today we put a good performance and we win to go to the final. And we're really happy, yeah?
And now to netball. President of the Uganda Netball Federation, Seria Babirye, has been suspended from office for a period of 3 months by that country's Minister of Sports. At the center of the row are issues bordering on governance, accountability of funds, and general management of the Uganda Netball Federation. And that's all for this Monday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a very good Monday. And that's it for this Monday, April 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for beginning your week with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Butte in Washington, wishing that you will have a great week.